The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is Blair Horner, and are we proud and delighted to have him. This is a guy who knows more about New York state government than anybody I know. He shows up on the front pages of the New York Times and every other place. He's the executive director of New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. He's back again, and we are very happy to have him. Welcome back, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Yeah. See, that's what Mario Cuomo used to say to me all the time. I'd say something to him, he'd say, yeah. And then he'd say, yeah. I'd say, yeah. And it was sort of dismissive, but I didn't mean it that way. And I do apologize.
I'm not taking it that way. It's your show. I'm glad to be here.
I'm delighted. Okay, Blair Horner, let's bore the hell out of everybody and start by asking you about the ballot questions. Now, you know, there are ballot questions, and I've read them 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 times, but I've been waiting to talk to you so you would clarify what they actually are. So NYPIRG urges New Yorkers to vote yes on questions 1 through 4 and not to forget to flip over their ballots to answer the questions. Let's start with number one, the redistricting process. Take it, Blair.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There'll be 5 questions on the ballot. There's a 5th one, which deals with New York City's civil court. And you're absolutely right. The voters have to remember that when they get their ballot to flip it over and vote on the questions on the back. Proposal one is probably the most controversial of the 5. It deals with changing redistricting process in New York State. And it changes the amendment that passed 10 years ago that changed New York State's redistricting process. And it does it in a way that we believe makes the process better. So there's a number of things. It's sort of like 3 buckets. The proposal eliminates a lot of the dead wood that's in the state constitution, stuff that's unconstitutional or stuff that's in conflict with other provisions of the state constitution about redistricting. For example, the state constitution says you have to exclude aliens from the count for the districts, and yet there's another provision which says that you are supposed to count all residents of New York State
right.
when you develop the lines. And so they're not talking about Martian aliens. They're talking about aliens being somebody from outside of New York. So, I mean, that kind of stuff gets cleaned up. So that's bucket number one. Bucket number two, it advances some reforms. One is that it limits the number of state senators to 63. As you know, Alan, the state constitution says there's 50 state senators, but they're allowed to add to it. And so now New York is up to 63. And so it caps it at that. It can't go up or down.
So why is it at 63? It's because somebody's district was going to get eliminated, and they had
right.
to add a couple more just to make sure that no politician would be out of it, right?
And that's right. No politician left behind. It's also a way to jerry-rig the gerrymander process so that adding seats allowed, really historically, Republicans to maintain control in the state Senate.
Interesting.
On the assembly side, it's capped at 150 members, and has been since the Constitution was written. So there is a difference between the houses, and this provision keeps it at 63, and then also changes the timetable. The state constitution that was drafted in the amendment 10 years ago was drafted with an eye toward a state primary in September, and now it's in June. And so the timetables that are baked into the state constitution are all wrong, and that gets cleaned up. And then the third part of it is it deals with the voting rules and eliminates a lot of the partisan voting rules that exist in the state constitution and replaces it with sort of one uniform standard. So those are the 3 big things. And it's that last provision, the voting rules, that are the most, that is the most controversial of the question.
Why so controversial?
Well, under the current Constitution, the way it works is there's a commission that's set up. It's a so-called independent redistricting commission. The reason I say so-called is because it's not independent. It's just bipartisan. And if they come up, they're supposed to come up with the first draft of the maps. And if 7 of the 10 members of the commission, and they're equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats, there's 10 members, if 7 of the 10 agree to the maps, the legislature then has the power just to approve it with a majority vote. If they don't come up with maps, or the legislature rejects the maps that come up from the 7 out of the 10, currently, you need, and if each house is controlled by a different political party, you need 60% to approve the maps. And if it's one political party, it's 67% have to approve their own maps. So if the legislature draws their own maps, it's either 60%, if one house is controlled by each of the parties, or 67%, if both are controlled by the political parties. And the fact that I had to go through all this explanation gives you some sense of how complicated it is. That under the proposal, it just gets cleaned out and it says, if the commission, 7 of the 10 commissioners agree to the maps, the legislature approves it, the legislature wants to draw their own maps, it's a straight up 60% of the vote, no matter what the circumstances.
I have a reaction. Good grief. I mean, after all, the Democrats control everything in New York State now. Obviously, the Democratic governor will appoint the people who she's most compatible with. Why in the world would we anticipate that there'll be a problem? In the old days, sure, when the Senate was Republican constitutionally. But why in the world would we think there would be these kinds of problems that need to be solved?
Well, again, this stuff was written 10 years ago when the Republicans had a very tenuous hold on the state Senate. And as part of the deal with between then Governor Cuomo, then Speaker Silver, then Senate Majority Leader Skelos, they cobbled together this arrangement to make it harder. No one contemplated that there would be supermajorities in both houses, which there is now. Right now,
sure,
the Democrats have more than 67% control of the state Senate and state assembly. But Republicans complain that their minority protections are gone if you move from 67 to 60%, even if you are streamlining the voting process. And so that is, I think, the most controversial element of Proposal 1.
Now let's go to the concept of same-day voter registration and absentee ballots. Can we talk about that a bit?
Yeah, sure. So there's two other provisions, Proposals 3 and 4, which change the way voting occurs in New York. So Proposal 3 changes the state constitution on registration. And so under the state constitution right now, there's a blackout period 10 days before the election when you are not allowed to register to vote. And that on Proposal 3, that gets eliminated. So you can register to vote under the state constitution anytime. Now, there's a law on the books right now that says you can't register within 25 days, of course. And so if this proposal passed, Proposal 3, the legislature would then have to do something, either to somehow change the 25-day or not change it. So the proposal doesn't automatically create same-day registration. It allows it, and so there would have to be statutory language that would have to change. The second proposal, Proposal 4, eliminates the excuse requirement under the current state constitution, which says if you want an absentee mail-in ballot, you have to have a valid excuse. You're sick, you're traveling, whatever. And during the pandemic, the legislature passed a law saying, well, we consider a pandemic to be illness or potential illness. Therefore, you can mail in your absentee ballot. So this would eliminate that requirement going into the future when hopefully the pandemic ends. So those are the two changes on voting and elections. We think, by the way, both would make a lot of sense, and both would make New York's voting laws consistent with some of the best practices in the country.
Blair Horner, if you take a look at the way in which these voting provisions that you've been talking about, not only in the Congress of the United States, when they discuss them, or any other way, isn't it true that you could almost always find Republicans on one side of this issue and Democrats on another?
Well, certainly in New York, that's the case. Republican leaders have been campaigning, saying, just say no on these three questions. And, you know, certainly you can understand it from a political party's perspective in New York, where their enrollment is stagnating. The number of Democrats enrolled is increasing dramatically. The number of voters in New York who are not registering in any political party is now more than Republicans. And so they view it as, you know, a threat to their, you know, sort of an existential political threat. Now, again, I think that's the wrong way to look at it. The answer shouldn't be, well, let's make it harder for people to register and vote. It should be, let's make it as easy as possible to give people, make sure they can do their constitutional rights, and that Republicans should come up with whatever they have to do, sort of political position-wise, to appeal to enough voters that they can control the state or have a fighting chance. But instead, they're arguing against, on the voting questions, they're arguing against following best practice in the country. To some extent, you see that playing out across the country. There's no doubt about it. That the theory, there appears to be a political operating theory that you make it harder for people to vote, that can benefit Republicans.
Exactly right. Now, let's talk a little bit about my favorite subject, Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo, it looks like, may enter a complicated primary. First of all, if there are six people in a primary, anything can happen, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the more the merrier at a certain level from those of us who watch from afar. But within the process, there's no minimum requirement. There's no runoff requirement in New York.
Exactly.
So if you have a number of challengers, then you can win with, you know, theoretically 20% of the vote.
And there are those of us, I've been writing columns about this from quite early, who think, knowing something about Andrew Cuomo, some people call him the Dark Prince, I don't know, that he will go into the primary process. There'll be six candidates, and there'll still be enough Cuomo voters to elect him in a Democratic primary. Yes?
Well, I mean, who knows what the former governor will do? I mean, his spokespeople have said he has no intention to run for any office in the future. And so let's just take that at face value. It raises the question, why is he allowed to keep the $18 million in campaign contributions? That's supposed to be for people that are either a party official, a public official, or a candidate for office. If he's none of the three, he should give the money back. And so maybe there's some sort of game the former governor is playing where he wants to show some leg that he might actually run so that he can continue to use the $18 million to fund whatever he's interested in doing. But I think in our view, he would have to declare candidacy or give the money back.
Since when does anybody give the money back? They always keep it.
That's not entirely true. Former Governor Spitzer figured out a way to give the money back. Former Attorney General Eric Schneiderman did the same thing. Former Comptroller Alan Hevesy did too. There are ways you can give it back, either pro rata for the donors or to charities or to the political party. But they shouldn't be allowed to just keep it and hire press people to attack the, you know, people that they don't like, public officials that they don't like, which is appears to be the strategy for the $18 million that the former governor had.
Well, let's go there for a moment. And now there seems to be a little bit of a war, and I find it puzzling, between the governor and the attorney general, who, of course, wrote the report that basically put him out of the running. And so now he attacks the attorney general, and the attorney general turns around and attacks him. But who he is not attacking is former lieutenant governor, now Governor Hochul. I've been surprised by that because Hochul hasn't been any too nice about Cuomo.
Yeah, I don't know what the former governor is thinking. Clearly he's bitter at the attorney general's report. And some of it, you know, it's like there's a straw man that gets created that somehow he was, you know, like driven from office when he resigned. I don't quite exactly know what the game plan is, but he has a big war chest, as I mentioned before, and he may choose to be more confrontational with the current governor, Hochul. I don't know. I mean, it is the attorney general's report, you're right, which two reports, really, the one on the nursing home deaths and the one on the harassment issues that sort of created the environment in which the governor felt compelled to resign. And so he obviously is not happy about that. And you know, I understand why he would be unhappy. Nevertheless, it is to me remarkable that he can just use the $18 million to sort of launch, pay for lawyers and press people to just do nothing, as far as I can tell, other than attack his political enemies, at least as he sees them. I don't know what he's going to do about Governor Hochul. I mean, there's the element of the book deal. I mean, there are members of the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, the State Ethics Watchdog, which want to claw back the $5 million that were allowed to the governor for the book deal because he used public resources to do it. And, you know, that there is another factor in terms of potential threats to the governor. So, and again, I don't know what he's doing with regard to what his strategy is. It may be what you talked about before, which is he wants to throw his hat back into the ring. But he hasn't said that, and his mouthpieces have said he's not. And so I'm not exactly sure what his plans are.
Well, if you have $5 and you want to put it on the table, I'm willing to bet you he's not done yet. And of course, you know more about this than anybody because you once worked for him.
That's right. When he was Attorney General.
When he was Attorney General, right. But you know his political character, right?
Well, look, it would make sense to me that he would want to both ensure that his tarnished image is as not tarnished as possible, that he would want to keep his hand in the mix because you never know, right? If you can't, you know, the old lottery sort of, you know, slogan that, you know, you can't play. If you don't play, you can't win. You know, I mean, to certainly be out there couldn't hurt, even if he's not necessarily interested or can't run this time around. He may be able to rehabilitate himself in a way that will allow him to run in the future. So the $18 million, I would agree he's going to want to keep it. To me, it's just sort of crazy that he can't. I mean, what kind of laws on the books that allow that to happen, where somebody can leave office, not be involved in the political party, not be running for office, and just keep the money and spend it, you know, within guardrails. He can't go out and buy a mansion or a yacht with it. But, you know, he can basically he's running the biggest political action committee in New York State right now from people that donated to him when he was running for governor. It doesn't make any sense.
Blair Horner, you wrote a recent column bringing accountability to New York state government, and quote, ever since former Governor Cuomo resigned, the calls for reform have been growing. But the problem of Albany are not the result of the failed ethics enforcement system. The problems go much deeper. And then, of course, she says that she wants an honest government and an honest approach to ethics. But people who are incumbent somehow have always been able to shift the lines of demarcation on ethics, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's two. It's related to what I wrote, but also to your question. I mean, there's sort of two problems. One is, like, you want a state ethics watchdog that enforces the law without fear or favor, but someone has to pick the state ethics watchdog.
Exactly.
And so how do you come up with a system that minimizes to the greatest extent possible political influence, and yet you have a system where people get picked? So I think what the governor, Governor Hochul, is grappling with right now, and she's been, you know, very again, it's been reported that the Times Union, I think it was, that she was going to want to blow up the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, but replacing it, you know, I think she's viewed this. I mean, anytime you become governor as a result of a scandal, there is some pressure, legitimately, to fix whatever led to the scandal in the first place. And part of what happened with the former Governor Cuomo is the failure of the ethics guardrails that existed and its enforcement. The book deal is a good example where the ethics watchdog staff made the decision to allow the highest paid governor in the country to have a $5 million book deal and never ran it by the commission itself. And so how did all that happen, right? So there's that whole issue. But the thing that I wrote about was that, you know, you need an accountable government generally if you want to have an ethical government. That if people feel like they're being held to account for their performance, that means almost by definition that they have to behave ethically. And so there are other issues. Failures of government oversight require, I think, more thoughtful and wonky sort of responses. And that was where I was going with my column. I was sort of wonky. My wonk hat was on.
To which I say, you want to bet, you know, politicians are politicians. They feather their own nests, we know that. And we'll be watching Governor Hochul very closely when it comes to that. Now, I want to go to one of your other areas of expertise, Blair Horner, and that is higher education in New York. I just read that SUNY has fewer students than it had before. And I'm wondering what your take on the financing of higher education is now.
Yeah, you know, some of it is, you know, demography to some extent is destiny, and the State University of New York is really based in the non-New York City areas of the state. And generally speaking, those are the areas of the state that lost population over the last 10 years. Excuse me. And so, and most notably, the 18 to 35-year-olds are the place, is the part of the population that leaves. And it's the lack of economic activity in upstate New York primarily. And so SUNY reflects, I think, what's happening in the general population. When we've looked at the numbers, where SUNY's student population craters the deepest is in the community colleges. Now, has that changed through the pandemic? I doubt it. People don't want to go back to classrooms. Maybe they're taking online classes. And, you know, so some of it is that there's been this huge drop-off in the community college. I mean, really staggering numbers, huge reductions. One of them, it was Columbia Green, although don't quote me on that, had seen something like a 50%.
What do you mean, don't quote you on that? Everybody's going to be listening
to
the radio.
Know, I can't remember which community college it was, but there was one where it's over 50% of the student population. That's the reduction over the last 10 years. And so you've had these gigantic reductions. At the four-year colleges, there have been reductions, where the student populations have been more or less stabilized has been at the university centers. And so some of it is what's happening in New York generally. I mean, SUNY does not have New York City. That's where the City University is. And they have not seen the same dramatic reductions in student population that SUNY has.
Interesting.
So it's part of it that, and part of it is something else that's going on in New York where young people are leaving. And one way to leave a state is to go to college outside of the state and then move to that state. So I think it's partly that. And just to go to the financial question,
exactly.
Of course, a huge portion of the funding of the state university system comes from student tuition and fees. And if students aren't going to those schools, they face a financial pinch. And if the state doesn't come up with the dough to make up the difference, SUNY has a financial pinch.
Yeah, but Blair Horner, you know, I'm so old that I remember the way it used to be. It used to be when the Senate Republicans were running things on one side of the House, they took care, they had a constituency, the private colleges, number one, and I think to some degree the upstate SUNYs, whereas the New York Democrats, the New York City-oriented Democrats, took care of CUNY. Has that changed?
Well, I mean, the Republicans really can't take care of anybody anymore because they're such a minority party in New York State. But I think I think there's a very powerful constituency within the Democratic Party that looks out for the state university system, and that is the union. I mean, the union is part, you know, is part of the teachers' union, and they're formidable and smart and savvy, and they have staff all over the. Members all over the state. And I don't think that there's any, I have not detected in any of my conversations with the Democrats any reluctance to help public colleges. Now, there may be some reluctance to help the independent sector. That I don't know.
Yeah, they like to be called independent. They don't like private.
That's right.
Yeah.
I
apologize in advance because I know I'll hear from them.
But I mean, we work with, you know, independent colleges and universities too. And so, their state support is different because, you know, obviously NYU, New York University, has a different need for help from the state than, say, a school like the College of St. Rose in Albany. They have different endowments and they have different needs and that kind of stuff. So it's a very varied sector. And when we've looked at the smaller liberal arts colleges in the independent sector, they're definitely getting hammered in the same way as the state university, but they may not have the safety net of the state resources.
Well,
it's true that I agree with your basic sort of point about the history when you used to ride, wear your tri-cornered hat and stockings and ride your horse to work. I remember that. I remember you telling me about those days. But I think the Democrats have picked up the slack when it comes to higher ed. They seem genuinely committed to cover all the sectors. The question always is, where does the money come from?
And let's remember, a lot of those Democrats, even though they're Democrats, small d, large d, whatever you want, went to private colleges. So there's always...
Yes, many do. Many went to public, too. And, you know, again, the SUNY is an economic engine, one of the few economic engines that still fires in upstate New York. And so if you're looking at the long-term interests of the state, you really have to have a robust higher educational institution everywhere.
Okay, we're almost out of time, so I want you to do this in a minute or so. New York City mass transit. Riders, according to you guys, NYPIRG, riders rely on New York City subway and buses to get to and from school, work, and home. And we've had subway floodings, we've had problems, we know we have financial problems. What's the outlook?
Well, I mean, we'll have to see what happens with the congressional budget reconciliation package, which really ties into how much aid will be made available to mass transit systems across the country. I mean, partly what's happening in New York City is a huge drop-off in ridership because of the pandemic. And yet, as a practical matter, the lifeblood of the city to get workers around is the mass transit system. Plus, you have climate change, which is increasing the threat to underground subways, as well as even buses on roads. And so there's definitely a need for a real emphasis on additional funding for mass transit. By the way, it ties into one question we didn't really talk about, is Proposal 2. There is a proposal on the ballot to give New Yorkers a constitutional right to clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. And while that all by itself doesn't do, it's just a part of the Constitution, it will inform, I think, the policymaking debate going forward. And New York, with its industrial, with its legacy of industrial pollution, the threats of climate change, which I referred to, I think it's an important provision as well.
So I'm so sorry, Blair, because, I have 1,000 more questions for you. But we are out of time. Our guest has been Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPIRG, the man who knows more about New York State government and who shot Liberty Valance. Blair, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Alan.